You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a sultry August morning in 1970, the battered body of a young woman was hoisted from a dry well just outside Hogansville, Georgia. Author and investigator Clay Bryant was there witnessing the macabre scene. Then 15, Bryant was tagging along with his father, Buddy Bryant, Hogansville chief of police. The victim, Gwendolyn Moore, had been in a violent marriage. That was no secret. But her husband had connections to a political machine that held sway over the Troop County Sheriff's Office overseeing the case. To the dismay and bafflement of many, no charges were brought. That is, until Bryant followed his father's footsteps into law enforcement and a voice cried out from the well 3 decades later. The book that we're featuring this evening is Solving the West Georgia Murder of Gwendolyn Moore, A Cry from the Well, with my special guest, state trooper and investigator, Clay Bryant. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Clay Bryant.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the case. It was, it's been a very high point of my life.
Absolutely, and this book is testament to that. Let's start off right away with you were raised in Hogansville, Georgia, West Central Georgia. Your father was the local police chief. Tell us about your upbringing and some of the things that you learned from your father, Buddy Bryant.
Well, to be quite honest, for the most part, I was raised on the seat of a police car. My dad was a local police chief, and I was... spent every waking hour I could with my dad. He was kind of my hero, you know. He was kind of a mixture between Andy Griffith and Chief Gillespie and a little bit of Will Rogers. He had a saying and some philosophy about everything. As Southern police chiefs go, he was well educated. He went to the Southern Police Institute. He was in the first graduating class of the Georgia Police Academy in 1966. He was an FBI fingerprint expert. He loved his craft, and he did everything he could to further himself in it. And he also loved people, and that's the one thing that I admired about him most. He had time for everybody in the world. Didn't matter if you were, you know, the president of the bank at lunchtime at a civic club, or if it was one of the miscreants from in town that were banging on the door at Sunday morning at 6 o'clock trying to explain what happened to him on Saturday, you know. It was just it was a great place to live. Everybody knew everybody, and it was Mayberry, if you can envision that. I had a wonderful childhood.
Now, let's get to a time and a case that affected your father greatly, and obviously that's what this book is about, the events of August 3rd and August 4th, 1970. Tell us what had happened. You talk about a crowd had gathered around South Lee Street at the old house adjacent to Junior Turner's yard. Tell us about the call that your father got and what happened to you and your father that day.
Well, as I did a lot of time, I was tagging along with my dad. I don't exactly remember what I was doing in the police station with him that morning, but he got a call from the sheriff's office, and there'd been a body found in a well just outside the city of Hogansville. And at that time, the sheriff's office wanted my dad to go out there and take some photographs of the body and the recovery. So course, he asked me, he said, "You want to go?" So jumped right in a police car with him, and we rode out, myself and he and one of the other officers rode out just literally a stone's throw outside the city limits of Hogansville. And there in an abandoned well, about 20 feet down, you could see the body. It was looked as if it was in a fetal position, but like kneeling to pray. And I guess that's just the way that Gwendolyn landed in the well. It was a dry well. It had been curbed to a house years before, and the house had burned down. And people in the neighborhood actually had been using the old well to throw garbage in. And she was down in the well. And there was a number of folks there. One of the kids in the neighborhood had found a body because they were looking for her from the night before. It was, you know, said that they hadn't found her the night before, and she was, her husband had been looking for her and one thing and another, but there was probably 20, 25 folks around, and we're talking about, you know, rural Troup County, Georgia. So there was just a few houses there, but everybody right close by was there watching the scene, and I never will forget the thing that moved me the most about it. A deputy sheriff went down on a cable that a wrecker sent down as when they and put a cable around the lady, and when they raised her up out of the well, she was on that cable, and you know, as a cable stretches, it spins around, and it was just a terrible display. And the sad thing is, on the side of the well over there were three of her children. And
yeah,
I never will forget that. That sight stayed with me for a very long time, and it does today.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody knew that there was, you know, that she had endured a violent marriage, and all the neighbors had seen evidence of that. And there was very little doubt as to what had happened in the case, and but nothing ever happened in the case, and it ate my dad alive. I mean, it was the one thing that he just didn't ever turn loose of. He'd see her husband on the street, and he'd say, you know, he should be on death row in Tattnall County for what he did, and he said that, you know, it was just inhumane that it never was pursued the way that it should have been. There was no justice for her.
Now, as you write in the book, you tell us about the history of Marshall Moore. This is the mm-hmm. man that was looking for his wife, and we haven't talked about what happened on August 3rd, 1970, but let's go back to Marshall Moore and Gwendolyn, but how Marshall Moore, the background of Marshall Moore, before we find out how he came to marry Gwendolyn and then the life that Gwendolyn and the children endured under the
right
under Marshall Moore.
Marshall was raised in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains in North Georgia in Raven County. And he was raised in a family that there was a lot of domestic violence. And they were raised in a place where, you know, it was very rural, very poor. And Marshall watched his father mistreat his mother. And it was a family legacy that was passed down through the years. As a matter of fact, his grandfather, and I was told this by members of his family, had killed his grandmother back in the 30s in Rabun County and burned her body on a pyre in Rabun County in the 30s, and nothing was ever done about that. But back again, back then, nobody knew it but the family. And it was just a legacy of brutality that it was passed down to him. Now, he and his father, actually, the first time he got into trouble, he was as a juvenile. He and his father committed a burglary. His father went to prison, and he did some time in a juvenile home, and when he left there, he found his way to Adamsville, which is on the west side of Atlanta, right outside of Atlanta. And he a family took him in, and they were neighbors with the McDaniels, which Gwendolyn Moore was Gwendolyn McDaniel prior
right.
to prior to their marriage. Her parents were good, loving people, hard working. He worked for the railroad and this and that. And Marshall came down, and she married him when she was 15 years old. And she, while she was just had gotten out of the middle school at the Margaret Fane Middle School in Adamsville in Fulton County. And immediately, she was pretty much tried to be isolated from her family, and her path was set. And it took 15 years from the marriage to the time that she was lifted out of that well. And she endured some unspeakable atrocities. And again, this came from her children and members of his family and her family. And it's a horrific story, actually, but it's one that needed to be told.
You explain in this book that to fully understand the situation here, you talked about the grandfather killing the grandmother and putting in a fire pit and no one saying anything. But this is 1970 in Troup County, Georgia, unbelievably. And you say that to fully understand the cultural, political, and social climate in 1970, Troup County, Georgia, you said you need to know a little bit of the regional history. And we're talking about John Will and Lou Shepherd and their offspring. And so tell us about the cultural, political, and social climate in 1970 and where this culture started and some of the players involved.
Well, the Shepherd family originated just across the Alabama line from LaGrange, Georgia. They had several children, but some of the children migrated down to Phoenix City, Alabama, and some of them came into LaGrange and set up businesses here. The ones that went down to Phoenix City, they helped build a gambling criminal empire, gambling, illegal liquor, prostitution, everything, every vice you could imagine. Time magazine in the 40s and 50s regarded, in a expose, regarded Phoenix City as the wickedest city in the United States of America. As a matter of fact, General Patton had it declared off limits in a letter to the department, to the Secretary of the Army, when they were preparing the Third Army to go to Europe. He stated the fact that he said if it were up to him, he'd take a Sherman across the river bridge between Columbus and Phoenix City and destroy Phoenix City for the terrible influence it was having on the men that he was trying to train to go fight a war.
Yeah.
But the guys that went south to Phoenix City was primarily Hoyt Shepherd. A family referred to him as Big Hoyt. He opened up a place called the Bama Club, and it was run by Hoyt and his family. And they ruled Phoenix City with an iron hand. They had the law enforcement, prosecute everything that had to do with the politics in Phoenix City, Alabama, they owned. And in doing so, it enabled them to literally get away with murder for years. The stories of Phoenix City have been well chronicled in the Phoenix City Story, and one book by Ms. Margaret Ann Barnes, The Tragedy and Triumph of Phoenix City, Alabama. And 1955, Phoenix City was the Attorney General-elect was murdered before he could take office on the streets of Phoenix City by the sheriff's chief deputy.
Wow.
And that resulted in martial law being declared in Russell County and Phoenix City, Alabama. That is the only time martial law has ever been declared in the United States of America. There was a big federal investigation, and it resulted in, a couple hundred indictments and several convictions ranging everywhere from murder to aiding folks that were in the gambling business. It was quite the deal. But a lot of those folks migrated, and their influence migrated up into Troup County, Georgia. And they came in and took control of the Troup County Democratic Committee. And back then, there wasn't any opposition in the South to in the way of party politics. You were a Southern Democrat or you weren't anything. And
right.
they presented their candidates to run and for judgeships and law enforcement positions and prosecutor positions and every other position. And it wasn't just in Troup County, but that's just the way it was in a lot of cities and towns. The sheriff had a lot of power. He and the judges, they held the key to the jail. And because of that, the power they wielded was just, remarkable. And because of that, it allowed for a lot of criminal enterprises to develop. And the result of that was situations like Gwendolyn Moore. Her husband had some ties to some of these folks that were in these criminal enterprises, and because of that, her case was just basically swept under the rug.
How about the collusion between Shepard and the Sheriff Matthews, but also that 4 months after Marshall, everyone knew that he had killed his wife and put her into this well, he remarried the Shepherd's daughter, Priscilla, just to demonstrate the power that he had to elude or evade prosecution for this. Now, with this evading prosecution for this charge, I know that he marries Priscilla Shepherd, but how do they actually go about not prosecuting this marshal at all? How is that possible?
Well, you got to remember now, this is 1970 and not 2020. There wasn't any support groups. There wasn't anybody. She was not from there. There wasn't anybody standing on the courthouse steps, having a fit because she, in the words of one of her sons, my mother was a prisoner and a slave. And again, they weren't from the area. They came in, and he'd made some friends in high places simply because of how he was. And there was no comfort for her. I mean, there was no place to go. And the neighbors actually would witness her getting beaten and would hide her under the house. It was just a tragic story. Again, there weren't any support mechanisms for anybody back then. And even though she left him on several occasions, sometimes would go to his family and sometimes to hers, but he'd always track her down. Back to that same statement of her son, mother was a prisoner and a slave. And that's what she was until she died. And after he married the Shepherd lady, he couldn't be quite as, rough with her as he had with Gwendolyn, because he would have been the one that wound up in the well if that were the case.
Mm-hmm. Let's use it as an opportunity just to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about that he wouldn't lay a hand on Priscilla Shepherd. That certainly he wouldn't do that. But you talked about that the beatings that Gwendolyn endured were even witnessed by the sheriff's deputies because they had, you remarked it, that because it's so hot, they had these big windows. So they were called once upon a time by the Turners, and these police officers, these law enforcement, witnessed the beating and the berating of Gwendolyn Moore at the hands of her husband, didn't they? And nothing was done.
Well, on the 28th day of July of 1970, she was law enforcement was called. She went to the hospital, and she received stitches and treatment in the emergency room, and sent back home to endure some more. And what, less than a week later, she's dead in the well. But it's hard for me. On several occasions, neighbors had called and reported the violence that they were witnessing, and it was always a case, you know, I guess their answer was, you know, a man's home is his castle. And there's no explanation for me for that. I mean, you know, it was just so blatantly wrong that there are just no words to try to defend what they did. I just can't.
Let's talk about August 3rd, 1970, because later you talked to this, one of the sons, Alan, who was 14 at that time. And Alan will never forget what happened that day. He was old enough to remember, and he was involved, at least in his mind, in the death of his mother. Let's talk about August 3rd, 1970. You say that Gwendolyn had let Alan, Ricky, and Larry go to the swimming pool in Hogansville with a neighbor, but however, a marshal showed up at the swimming place and ordered the kids into the car. Take it from there. Tell us what happened that day.
Well, actually, he had come home, and she told him that the kids had gone to the swimming pool. That's when the worst of this beating took place, the one that Ronnie Turner witnessed from his front porch. And it was a tremendous beating. He described vividly what had happened. And Marshall, after the beating, I don't know if she was unconscious or what, but she was on the floor, and Ronnie could see it through the bedroom window. As long as she was standing up, he could see what was happening. But he said he never would forget that Marshall had left. At that point, he was going to get the kids at the swimming pool. He had to have complete and total control over every aspect of everybody's life. And he said that Gwendolyn got up out of the floor and pulled us up on the bedpost. And the last time he saw her, she was going out the door. And we're talking about, I'm talking to him in 2002, late 2002, early 2003. And he vividly describes the clothing the woman has on.
Wow.
And which you have to question the ability of a eyewitness sometime, you know? And I said to Ronnie, I said, Ronnie, you're telling me that she had on a white blouse, yellow shorts, and she got up out of the floor putting her blouse back on. And I said, you know, how can you remember that? You saw it one time 33 years ago. And he looked me straight in the face and said, no, Chief, I've seen it nearly every day for 33 years. And that, you know, such a powerful statement, you know.
Yeah.
And at that point, she made her way over to Junior Turner's house, where Junior's daughter and her boyfriend were there. And as they had done in the past, they hid her in the crawl space under their house to keep her away from Marshall. And Alan, when they got back from the pool, she was gone. And, of course, Marshall didn't want any part of her going around the neighborhood looking like she looked at that point. And he sent the kids out to look for her. Well, Alan knew that she had, in the past, sought refuge under the house. So he goes under the house. He finds his mother under the crawl space of the house like a dungeon. She's propped up against an old space heater. And eyes swollen shut, you know, she's bloody. And Alan, in her talking, she tells him that she's going to try to get some help and she's going to try to come back and get him. And Alan, he comes out from under the house. He tells his dad he couldn't find her. And at that point, this Marshall's search for her continues, you know. And the next thing you know, she's found in the well the next morning. Alan, when I interviewed him in 2002 about this after the case came back up, you know, he actually was, he didn't run away from home. He was run away from home when he was 15 years old, and he went, and an aunt took him in down in LaGrange, Georgia, and he stayed with her for a couple of years till he went in the Navy. She signed for him to go in the Navy as his guardian. Spent 20 years in the Navy, you know, just a good, productive citizen. And when I talked to him on the side of the interstate that day, after I'd called and told him that I was opening the case back up, he had tears running out of his eyes, and he said if I had just taken her by the hand and taken her and ran to the police station, maybe my mama would be alive today. And that had haunted that man for his entire life. And in his own words, it had profoundly affected him and his relationships with other people and so forth. It was, you know, this terrible incident didn't just affect Gwendolyn. It affected a lot of people, and him especially.
You talked about how this case affected your father. And so we fast forward to 1980, and one of the big dream of your father. And what was this dream? And tell us a little bit about what happens in 1980 with his effort to achieve this dream.
My dad was everybody says, you know, you got the greatest dad in the world, and, you know, my parents are this, or my child's this. My daddy was a fair-minded man, and he treated everybody well. And if you needed putting in jail, he was all for it. But he tried to do the right thing. And he saw this conduct go on, not just in this case, but other cases. In 1980, he decided that he was going to run for sheriff and try to clean his mess up. And the summer of 1980 was the hottest year on record up to that point. It was, I forget how many days in August that it was over 100 degrees. And he basically walked to every residence in Troup County. And in a five-man race, it narrowed down to him and Sheriff Bailey in a runoff. And my dad was going to win that runoff pretty much by a landslide, because people at that time had become a little more educated and saw the things that had gone on, and it was just time to change. And 10 days before the runoff election that my dad was surely going to win, he succumbs to his third heart attack at the ripe old age of 46. And he was followed by one of the guys that was in the race with him, was a past sergeant of our local state patrol, Georgia State Patrol Post, and actually had been my boss when I first went to work for the Georgia State Patrol. His name was Gene Jones. He had endorsed my dad, and in return, upon my dad's death, my dad's campaign committee, they endorsed Jones, and he won the election. And at that point, a lot of the things turned around, and it started down a better road. He was a good lawman, and he held the office for two or three terms and did a lot of good, a lot of improvements, and just things like this ceased to happen.
Yeah. You were devastated, you write, after, obviously, the death of your father, heart attack, so close to achieving his goal. But you write that your father not only wanted you to be a peace officer, but he wanted you to be a prosecutor. So tell us about his dream of you being a prosecutor and what you did with that.
Well, my dad, he more than anything in the world, he wanted to see me be a prosecutor. And while I was on the state patrol, myself and one of my trooper comrades, we went to law school at Woodrow Wilson School of Law in Atlanta. And we graduated in June of 1980 and ready to take the bar exam and whatnot. And in a situation with my dad and he and his passing. So I never had any desire to be a lawyer, to be honest. But I just, you know, like I said, my dad was my hero, you know, and I wanted to make him happy. So he basically paid for me a free legal education that I promptly wasted. And I stayed with the State Patrol for about another year. They offered me his job as chief of police in Hoganville, Georgia, and for every wrong reason in the world, I took it. And stayed there for 12 years. And one thing about it, though, if you consider, you know, if you in life events like that, if you change one thing, you change everything. And had I not gone to the city of Hoganville, the events of my life would have played out in a different way. And this murder and three other cold case murders that I had the good luck to solve and resolve, they would have gone unpunished. And so, you know, I'm happy with the way it turned out. But it was, again, my father's dream of me being a prosecutor kind of went by the wayside. But I believe I can honestly tell you that he looks down at the accomplishments that came from it. I think he's well pleased.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity, Clay, to stop for this from our sponsor, which is ZocDoc. Just like many of you, I avoided going to the doctor during the pandemic. I skipped my physical and my dental cleaning and didn't see the eye doctor. But now that everything is opening up, it's time to catch up on our regular health care. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment, in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Whether you need a primary care physician, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, ZocDoc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, and I'm one of them. It's my go-to whenever I need to see a doctor. ZocDoc is great. You should try it. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/truemurder. Now, Clay, we were talking about your father's wish that you become a prosecutor, and this case gone completely cold. It still stayed with you, but you got a call in fall 2002 from the district attorney, Roy Olinger. Tell us what happened in this phone call, what was imparted to you.
Well, Roy told me, he had retired from the GBI, and he went to work for Pete Scandalakis at the district attorney's office, and he was fixing to retire. And he called and told me that, you know, the job was coming open and that maybe I'd like to talk to Pete, who was, you know, a friend of mine, and get back into law enforcement because I had left law enforcement, been out about 10 years. And I called Pete Scandalakis, and he told me, yeah, we'd be interested in you coming to work for us. So I applied for the job, and, of course, history shows that I went to work there in the DA's office as an investigator in Troup County. And as I'd been to work 10 days, I think I went to work on October the 15th, and I was sitting at the office, and I got a call from an investigator with the sheriff's office, and he said, Clay, you remember a situation where a lady was found in a well in Hoganville back in 1970, and we're talking 33 years later, and he said, there's no record. We don't have anything about it. And he said, I'm looking at a death certificate that says clearly marked this was homicide, describes the injuries and how they, over a period of days, how they were inflicted. And, you know, and it was just like the light went on, you know. I said, not only do I remember, I said, her name was Gwendolyn Moore. He said, that's right. And I said, I was standing there when she came out of the well. And, you know, it shocked him. It shocked me. It was just like, you know, divine intervention. And he said, I'm going to send you a copy of this death certificate and see if maybe you can help this lady. The young lady's name was Leslie Power, and she had actually was a great niece of Gwendolyn Moore. And when she was cleaning out her grandmother's effects, she found this death certificate that of a great aunt that she never knew she had. And she just wanted to, because of the questions raised on the death certificate, she wanted to find out something about it. And Larry said, I'm going to fax the death certificate over to you. And he did. And I get to looking at the top of the, at the death certificate. And of course I'm looking at the meat and potatoes, if you would, of certificate about the injuries and the fact that it's marked a homicide and what the cause of death was. And I look at the top of the facts, and it's October the 24th, 2002.
Yeah.
It's my daddy's birthday.
Wow.
I know. I don't believe. I'm not a paranormal guy, but when I saw that, it was just like an epiphany. You know, he had such an interest in this case for so long, and again, I don't. I'm not a big promoter of paranormal activity. However, I do believe in divine intervention. I think sometimes God puts folks in places and in situations to where they might can right a wrong or do some good. And I believe this was surely one of those.
Yeah.
And we started with the investigation from there. I looked at the report. I had a lot of people help me. We found records from 33 years old that there's no way on God's green earth you would ever should have been able to find them, you know. That was before things were archived and this and that. We found the things that we needed to do from a record standpoint to be able to reopen the case and travel forward, and we did. Some of the things in the old GBI report, when they talked to Alan Moore, one of the things that they talked to him, I think 3 or 4 days after mother's funeral, and what he said, and he related the story about finding his mother and this and that, and he tells the case agent, you know, my dad killed my mother, and if he finds out I'm talking to you, he'll kill me too.
Yeah.
You know, that's a powerful statement coming from your child, you know.
Yeah.
But we were able to, the problem that we were going to have was that autopsy was done by a medical examiner in LaGrange, Georgia, Dr. Joseph Krafka. Dr. Krafka had long since passed away.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have somebody that could testify to the cause of death and didn't have anybody to authenticate that record. So without that, we were dead, going to be dead in the water. So I contacted the GBI and Dr. Chris Sperry, who I had had dealings with him on several occasions. He was the head pathologist for the Georgia State Crime Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get an appointment with him. I took the death certificate and the things I had with me up there. And he said, well, Clay, he said, I think there's a possibility that we could actually come up with a legitimate cause of death But in order to do that, we've got to exhume her body and look for the injuries it caused. And, you know, at that point, you don't really know what, you know, you don't want to open a lot of really ugly wounds. This family that were the victims of this mess, without, you know, involving them in the decisions you make. And we had a meeting, myself and Pete Scandalakis, who, without his support, none of this would have ever happened. We had a meeting with the family, Alan, her sister, several nieces and nephews, and they Alan said, "I want my mother exhumed." And that allowed us to be able to, by giving us permission and being the next of kin, we were able to exhume her body. And we took her to the crime lab. And, of course, you know, 33 years later, there's nothing but skeletal remains. And as Dr. Sperry was taking the remains out of the coffin, and he meticulously wash every bone and place it on the gurney, anatomically correct, building it, coming back, you know, from the skull down. And what we thought was, in accordance with Dr. Krafka's cause of death, he said it was secondary to, most likely to, a concussion that had progressed over a period of time.
Right.
And that
right.
That was the cause of death. And in that, you would think maybe there's going to be a skull fracture there. Well,
yeah.
He took the skull cap off, and he says, you know, her nose has been broke more times than I can count. He said, but I don't see anything in her skull that I could say was an immediate cause of death.
Right.
So now we're about 6-7 months into this investigation, and this is absolutely one of the hardest things. You know, myself and Linda Caldwell, she was an assistant DA that was going to prosecute the case. We're sitting in the floor of the morgue, literally, you know, absolutely devastated by that news.
Right.
And, I mean, to the point where you got tears running out of your eyes because, you know, you're trying so hard to right a wrong that's been so long standing, and you hit this wall. And we're sitting there in that, you know, just at the bottom of the pit of emotion. And Dr. Sperry's steady working, cleaning up the remains and putting them on the table. And he gets down in the cervical section of her neck, and he says, "Oh, this is provocative." And, you know, that just kind of goes over the top of your head, you know, because you already heard the worst.
Yeah.
And then in the next sentence, he said, "Nope, this is murder." And what he had done, he'd gotten down to where the highway process covers your voice box. It's a bold, bony structure. And it is an absolute indicator of manual strangulation. And we went from the lowest low you could go to, she was manually strangled to death, you have a cause of death, to the top of the pinnacle of the roller coaster ride. You know, it was just, it's hard to describe. But that gave us a cause of death. We were able to, came back to LaGrange, immediately told Pete about it. I said, you know, we probably are going to, my thought was we were going to wait until we would wait until the grand jury met and we'd do an indictment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But came back, told Pete that, and I said, "Well, are we going to indict him?" And he said, "No." He said, "We're going to go take a warrant for him." He said, "Y'all done some great work on this case and devoted so much time to it. Y'all deserve that." And with that, went to the judge and gave our dog and pony show, and the next thing you know, we had a warrant for Marshall Moore, and we had him arrested. But Marshall had developed throat cancer, and they were able to put the trial off out for, God, a year or more. And finally, judge says, we're going to try him. If we have to do it on a stretcher, we're going to try him.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was a heck of a, it was a hell of a journey, you know. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you this, I believe, again, I'm not much on the paranormal, but I believe my daddy was looking down at us. He was proud of what we did.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about, and you take us right into that morgue where you're sitting with Linda Caldwell, another person that was instrumental in helping you get to that point that you could able to hopefully prosecute Marshall Moore for the murder of Gwendolyn, his wife Gwendolyn. And then there was this, you were worried because by the language that he was using, and then the discovery where he said it was murder, it was provocative, no, it was murder, and it's the hyoid bone, clearly indicating that she was strangled. So now with this, you talk about the delay in this because he has a good lawyer, he has a good attorney, and he's using every motion and he can to delay this. At the same time, he has this throat cancer that he's dealing with. Tell us just a little bit about that wait, you say about 2 years, I think, was back and forth.
It was absolutely arduous to us, you know. We wanted to try the case and find some resolution in it. And his attorney, named Bill Stemberger from Newnan, Georgia, excellent attorney. And, you know, he had discovery on the case. He knew what we had. And his mission in life at that point was postpone the inevitable. And he was able to do that. Marshall, the one thing that really got the judge, I think at one point, they said that they had a surgical procedure scheduled, and they put the thing off again, and they came for the surgical procedure, and it didn't happen. That's when Judge Keeble got upset and said, you know, if we have to try him on a stretcher, that's what we'll do. And that got us to that point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a... During that time, I will say this, because we arrested him, and it got a bit of publicity. And there was another case, 1987, that appearance. And a friend of mine, it was his father, disappeared. Myself and Pete Scandalakis, we ran a body shop. We took Pete's vehicle over there, and a storm had come through, and a tree fell on Pete's pickup truck. And we were over there. He said, you know, what'd be the chance of y'all looking into my dad's disappearance? And, well, we can do that. And victim's name was Fred Wilkerson. And as luck would have it, we were able to transition from that case right into Fred's case. And other than just the having to wait and be put off, my focus had jumped right onto Fred's case, and we were able to move forward with it, develop some information that hadn't been acted on before. And we actually were able to locate Fred Wilkerson's body in a well. And nearly 20 years later, and the family was able to give him a decent burial, and we were able to convict the persons responsible for killing Fred. And that just kind of rolled over into another case, and during the time that we operated doing this, actually went to a seminar in Charleston put on by the NCIS, who has the largest cold case investigative squad in the world because of, you know, they do naval bases and marine bases, and they are, you know, have a transient population, so a lot of their cases end up going cold. But they are the authority on cold cases pretty much in the country. And at that seminar, they actually used one of my cases to as a case study in the presentation. But they looked at my other cases, and they said, as far as they could tell, that during the time that we operated now, that I was the most prolific cold case investigator in the United States in single event homicides, which, you know, that was an honor that I thought was, you know, for them to say that. And of course, I'm very proud of it. But we solved four cold case murders. The oldest was 33 years old, and the youngest was 14 years old, and everybody got prosecuted. And in the subsequent ones after the Moore case, all of them found guilty and got life in prison. So we really had a good run. It was accomplishment that, you know, it'll go with me to my grave. And back to that same thing, I hope my dad looks down and says, you know, they really did well.
And his dream of you being a prosecutor really actually didn't come true, but in terms of aiding and being instrumental in prosecution, you end up being de facto prosecutor of sorts, in that at least these people were brought to justice. Like you say, these cold cases were closed.
The great thing was that every one of those where it says prosecutor, person that took the warrants for them on all these other cases too, is say Clay Bryant. And that's, yeah, you know, that's thrilling to me. We, you know, my dad, like I said, he was a person that, he had a saying for everything. I remember one time we were riding along in a patrol car. He'd ride with me sometimes when I was on the state patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm just going to tell you, boy, he said, the downfall of the police profession was the day they put an air conditioner in a patrol car. I looked at him and I said, what in God's name were you talking about? He said, think about it, son. He said, simplistic, but it's the truth. He said, that day it became more comfortable for you to isolate yourself from the people that you most need to stay in touch with to be good at your job. And you know what?
Yeah.
He was right. Of course, I can live with the air conditioner. But the theory is so true, you know, and it goes back to that thing, you know, if you're going to be a peace officer and not a policeman, you need to be part of your community. And that community needs to have faith and respect for you, because they know things that you don't. He also said this. He said, you know, everybody on the front pew of the First Baptist Church is my friend. He said, but there's a lot of things they can't tell me. And he said, there's good and the worst of people, and there's bad and the best of people. And you have to take them for what they are and use them to make the right thing happen. And in these cases, I think we did.
You said that he made a great distinction between being a peace officer and a police officer. What did he mean by that?
True. Well, you know, a policeman is exactly that. You know, a peace officer is a person that tries, in his view, a policeman is a guy that walked out there with the law book, and it's everything that, you know, the thing that I'm going to do for the most part is, if anything's against what the statute says, that's the only thing we're going to deal with. But if you're a peace officer, you want the right thing to happen. You know, you want to keep a family together if you can, instead of tearing it apart. You need to contribute, do good things in your community, not just police the community, but make it a better place for people to live. And that's kind of the way my daddy was. You know, in these other cases, you know, there were times when I just absolutely would hit an impasse. And it always seemed like, you know, I even get choked up talking about it. It always seemed like there was somebody sitting on my shoulder that steered me in the right direction.
Yeah. Let's get back to this prosecution that was so important to your father, so important to you, that this Marshall Moore be accountable for the murder of Gwendolyn. And some you had met with, and the prosecutors had met with Alan and his brothers and his siblings and his family to talk about whether they would exhume the body, and they were supportive, especially of you and your team, but spoke especially of you and their confidence in you, and they were willing to exhume their loved one's body in the aid of this prosecution. And you say that Marshall had an excellent attorney, but he went through every motion to be able to delay the inevitable trial. Let's talk about what happened to, again, have him evade culpability.
Well, as heartbreaking as it was to us, after about 2 years, it was inevitable. We're going to trial. So basically, Marshall goes in the hospital and he starts rejecting treatment. And I forget exactly what the date was, but Marshall Moore succumbed to his cancer prior to us being able to get him to trial. But, and as unjust as that was to me, the simple truth is that Gwendolyn Moore's voice was heard from that well. And he was held accountable for it. And he, to this day, from a judge and an authority a whole lot higher than us, he's being held accountable for it today. And, you know, again, that is what it is. I would have given anything in the world for us to go on to trial. Like I said, but, you know, his attorney knew the evidence that we had and the witnesses that were, that, you know, some of which now have passed away. But at the time, we stood ready to go to trial, and Lord knows, I thought we had everything, including a smoking gun. And there's no doubt in my mind he would have been convicted and held accountable for it. But that wasn't meant to be. But in the other subsequent cases, we were lucky enough to every one of those went to trial. And as of right now, we got five folks that are in jail for life in prison sentences for murders they committed and they've long thought they'd gotten away with. So, you know, we had a good run. And this hopefully is the first book in a series. We're going to probably write some about the others. But this one, actually, I wrote the book 15 years ago when I was doing the case. And that's why, so much passion in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are... our cases have been chronicled on 48 Hours Investigate. So Bill Curtis's cold case file of Discovery ID's murder book. And this case will be a new thing. Will be come out on, I think it's August the 27th or 26th on Discovery ID in a series called The Detective Diaries, which is compilation, I'm told, of what they believe to be the best cold case investigators in the country. And this is going to be one of their lead stories. It'll be 2 hours long. And it and one of the other cases, the Wilkerson case, will be the subject of that. So, More to come.
Congratulations. It's interesting, too, when you talk about that it was such a disappointment for him to evade this prosecution. However, as you write, he knew, his lawyer knew definitely, and it advised him that he was likely to be prosecuted. He was likely to be convicted, and he did the desperate measure of avoiding that prison time, avoiding that that court case period by starving himself to death, basically, essentially. So you had him on the run. Like you write in the early in the book, you talk about a hunting analogy, but this your father from the grave, Gwendolyn Moore from like you say, a cry from the well, but from the beyond, and then yourself in this fateful series of events, you become the person to prosecute, the person to make right this case. So I think that you talk about this providence and you talk about fate, and I think definitely this was justice for Gwendolyn Moore, an incredible journey to be able to do that, and with the help of so many people, but also with, like you say, your father looking over you, approving of what you finally were able to accomplish.
You know, and even in cases on down the road, there were times that things came up that there was absolutely no explanation for. There was one case where a guy was charged with kidnapping, rape, murder, and I was looking for another victim that he'd had in years past. There was no record of it whatsoever. And I end up eating dinner at a restaurant with some other folks, and a mention of the guy's name comes up, and a lady at the table is the victim of the crime that I was trying to, one of his victims. And she was the person that I could not find anything about. What's the chance of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
It can't be a thing in the world, except that's what the good Lord intended to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Clay, for coming on and talking about your book, Solving the West Georgia Murder of Gwendolyn Moore, A Cry from the Well. I know that this is a History Press release, and this is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere. Is there any way they might find out more information about this case?
Well, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote extensively about this case and other cases, and the Troup County Archives has a history of it in Troup County, LaGrange, Georgia, and they also sell the book as well. But anyone that would like to buy a book through the History Press or even from me, I got a social media page, and it's Clay Bryant Sr., just Clay Bryant SR on Facebook, and I'd be glad to try to talk with him about it or discuss anything he wanted to about it. It's an open book, and, you know, I'm proud of the work that we did, and again, I look forward maybe to doing three more. Hopefully their stories will be as good and compelling as this, and I feel like they are.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to more books by you. If this is any indication of the writing ability that you have. So thank you so much, Clay Bryant, for coming on and talking about Solving the West Georgia Murder of Gwendolyn Moore, A Cry from the Well. Thank you so much, Clay. It's been a pleasure. Good night.
I've definitely enjoyed it, Dan. Thank you. Have a pleasant evening.
You too. Good night.